Welcome to Food Conversations Season 7. Dear listeners, before we begin, we must not forget that we are living and working on Shkwempekulu, the ancestral, unceded, and, of course, actually stolen lands of the Shkwempek people. It's clear that doing everything we can to resolve the situation is an important and necessary responsibility for every one of us. Today, we are delighted to welcome Sue Moore back to Food Conversations. Now, Sue is a retired organic farmer who's been growing plants since she was a small child. She is the former owner of Sudoa Farms near Sorrento, and for a number of years has been both a prolific grower of seedlings and a prime force of nature for the teaching garden operated by the Shuswap Food Action Society. Today, we are going to talk about all that and more, including the processes associated with starting a garden, large or small, in the spring. Sue, welcome back to Food Conversations.
Thank you, Warren.
It's always good to have you here and get a little practical advice about how to grow things. And but let's start off sort of stepping back a little bit and looking at the, you know, the 10,000 foot view of what we're doing in this part of the world. Because the World Meteorological Association just issued a report on the climate crisis at the end of 2023, which was the hottest summer ever recorded by human measurement so far. And they noted that we have never been so close, albeit on a temporary basis at the moment, to the 1.5 centigrade lower limit of the Paris Agreement. In other words, we're touching into the level at which most experts say we're going to get into serious trouble. In addition, the president of the World Meteorological Association, Celeste Saulo, who, by the way, is a woman, the first woman president of the organization. She's from Argentina, and she has an interest in the broader picture as well as just climate. And she said that now food insecurity, is increasing. And since the beginning of the pandemic, when there were about 150 million people experiencing clear-cut food insecurity, there are now more than double that number. It's 333 million now. And she added that weather and climate extremes may not be the root cause per se, but they are aggravating factors. Now, watching things grow is something that's in your blood. What did you notice last summer when we were having this extraordinary heat wave? We were having a drought accompanying it. It was really a very trying condition for anybody who was trying to grow anything, pretty much. What did you observe as an expert?
Well, first of all, I'm not an expert. I'm just
we'll agree to differ on that subject.
But I did notice that seeds were not germinating that well. It was either too hot or too dry. That a lot of because we were under water restrictions, a lot of the foliage was shriveling and turning brown. And that cuts down the amount of food that the plant is actually getting through, you know, photosynthesis. It was generally a lower yield last year. But the main thing I've noticed over time is that when I first started gardening, I didn't even think about water. Mm. We had tons of water. You
right.
know, and the problem, farm. The problem was it was, you know, it would rain too much. but the last few years, I've certainly had to think about water.
What about predictability of weather patterns? There's a lot of talk in the literature about, and lots of experiences that people are having of extreme weather events, things that come out of the blue and suddenly you're subjected to a major disturbance of the weather pattern. How is that playing out as you see it in terms of what we try to grow and what we hope to grow?
Well, I think for the home gardener, the best thing to do is to just be aware and to take precautions. For instance, you know, by the way that you water, deep watering will encourage root growth at a deep level so that if we do have a hot
drought-like spell.
right spell, then the plant will survive because it has deep and thorough rooting system. And the other thing is mulching to prevent loss of water through evaporation. And also, I like underneath that mulch, if you can set up a drip irrigation system, that would use
a very economical way to use water.
It would be very economical way to use water, but, and here we have a really big but, don't put it on the timer.
Yes, don't anticipate what you think the weatherman is going to send your way.
Exactly. You go out there, you turn your irrigation on at an appropriate time, 5 o'clock in the morning. If you can manage that, leave it on for a few hours and then turn it off.
Does it influence also the kinds of strains of particular plants that you might grow because you're not so sure what's going to be coming down the pike in terms of weather? So you have some that can handle hotter, I know plant species handle different kinds of weather, but even within a species, the different strains, or do you have to have a different way of growing, like having some kind of protection in case there's a cold snap, have something sitting in a greenhouse that you can keep surviving through that, or do you think that's unnecessary?
I season extension is always a good idea. Mm-hmm. So having just sheets of remade that you can put down over your crop in the garden will allow you to plant a little earlier because it holds the heat, and will allow you to harvest a little later because it holds the heat.
I can't remember whether remade lets rain through or doesn't.
Remade lets rain and light. Yes.
Interesting stuff.
Very interesting stuff. Very, very useful stuff.
One wonderful way to keep critters out that you don't want in, little ones, without having to spray anything. It really adds a benefit.
But an added comment to that is that there is another product called ProtectNet, which you can use in the summer when you don't want that extra heat. And it does not hold heat, but it lets the light through, it lets the water through, and it keeps the bugs out.
Now, how does some ingenious technical expert arrange for a sort of covering that one will let everything through and the other won't? I mean, is it size of the pores in the mesh, or what is it?
A ProtectNet you can get in different sizes. Mm-hmm. You can remay as well. Mm. You can get a really heavy remay, which is up to about a -8 or -10 protection, which is used by a lot of nurseries for nursery plants rather than for food plants. But the ProtectNet has different sizes, and I would always recommend just getting the tightest one you can. Mm-hmm. It keeps out flea beetle and thrips and
stare them in the face and be gone.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Speaking of water conservation, the municipality and probably other jurisdictions around the province were very keen to restrict water use, which is obvious. But when they set out regulations for that, they did not distinguish between growing plants for food versus growing plants or lawns for simple ornamentation, what they call cosmetic planting. What are your thoughts about that in terms of establishing a difference between what we grow to give us food to eat as opposed to what we grow just to look pretty?
Well, I think that there should be no restrictions on the water for growing food. However, I think it would be a good idea to educate people on the best way to utilize the small amount of water that we have available.
When you were on the farm, you had all sorts of ways of conserving water or reusing water. In fact, you said to me when you were talking before the show, you said, make water do double duty. So why don't you talk a little bit about how to make water do double duty.
Well, my very first farm was in Warnock in the Fraser Valley, and it's notoriously short of water. We had a well, and we would have about a foot and a half of water in the well in the morning and a foot and a half of water in the evening if we didn't, you know, use water during the day. So we had all our drainage pipes disconnected so that all the gray water went into buckets. Any bath water that we utilized would be used for multi-purpose bathing, seeing as I had two children at the time. And that would be used to flush the toilet. So, you know, we would try and do double duty. We had an above ground swimming pool that we purchased and had the local water truck come and put water into it. And that's where the, kids played. That's where we got the water for the goats and the chickens.
Did you have rainwater barrels?
Yes. Yes. We certainly did then and highly recommend having them. It's especially in an area where your water is treated, it's much better for the plants to have that pure rainwater.
Yeah, some years ago, the city made available compost cones for households at cost. They purchased a whole whack of them, and then they sold them back to people for their cost, which was very modest. We still have a couple in our backyard. I wonder if it might be time we can delve a little bit into the sort of political process to have a similar program for rain barrels.
What a good idea, Warren.
Thank you. Thank you. I like that. Well, I just think it's about time. It's just recognizing that we have to pay attention to this. And municipalities have this power to, you know, purchase at in bulk and then redistribute to citizens at the cost that it costs them so that it's essentially a cost-neutral process, but it enlarges the capacity for the community in this particular case to conserve water and do a job that they really need to do. Remind listeners once again, I'm speaking with Sue Moore, who's a retired organic farmer, although I think retired is kind of an inappropriate term. I don't think you're ever going to retire, Sue. Former owner of Sudoa Farms and very active in the teaching garden run by the Shuswap Food Action Society. So let's look for a moment at another big issue, a big sort of global issue, and that is that there are a lot of young people these days who are pretty distressed about what they see coming down the pike in terms of the future of our planetary ecosystem. And that one of the things that always gets people going is something positive that they can do. And I wonder if you talk a little bit about having young people involved in gardening. And, you know, you have your own experience, which started quite early. But just in terms of what it does for a person in terms of giving them something constructive, positive, and climate-friendly, ultimately very climate-friendly, that they can do in their own lives.
I think getting a child started in gardening is something which we all need to do. We do have children come to the teaching garden. And Melanie is very involved with organizing that part of the activities. I know a young man who was given a greenhouse for a Christmas gift when he was 12 years old and has ended up having a very viable seed company.
My goodness.
Just through that one act of learning how to grow things and becoming excited
and,
about
and
it.
And seeing the magic of seeds turning into plants. There's something astonishing about a little tiny object that looks quite undistinguished, producing sometimes a very large plant of some sort that just does itself. You know, you give it what it needs, and away it goes.
Well, I mean, when you think about what a seed is, it has everything to start growing. It needs absolutely nothing from us except a little drop of water. You can have it on a piece of paper towel, give it a drop of water, and it will start growing. And then you have to, of course, plant it. Mm-hmm. But without that seed, we would not exist. So for me, to have food security, you need to have seed security.
Yes.
You can't rely on seed companies to have a huge variety of seeds available. What if for instance, the potato famine in Ireland,
mm-hmm.
what if a disease affected the only crop you have available?
You're hooped.
You're hooped. Yes. You're absolutely hooped. So you need to grow seed on a local level. You need to keep varieties available. And then hopefully those seeds would produce food for us to eat. And if there was a catastrophe, it would be an important seed in the ecosystem.
And sharing seeds was always something that people, I mean, not just people during the agricultural age, but even before that, wild seeds could be shared as well. And that custom of saying, well, I've got these seeds that do this sort of thing, and you've got seeds that do it. Let's trade, that kind of bartering process. It seems like it's almost endemic in the human relation, within the human family, kind of a relationship that we pursue to seek that little niche that you can put a seed into where it will really flourish, and then sharing that with other people so that they can do the same thing. Kind of a communal way of approaching growing.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Where actually I'm really excited this year because for the first time we're having a small seed garden at the teaching garden. And
so growing things for seeds?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think the hardest thing is going to be to stop people eating the crop.
You're eating next generation of plants, darn it.
But yes, it's really an exciting project. And I think that if people learn how to grow seeds and understand how important a seed is, then I would say that's the first step in gardening, but it's not the way I started. So it's,
you can start other ways.
You can start in so many ways.
Do you think for yourself that being exposed to planting, I know it when you're a kid, there's lots of other things on your mind sometimes, but just being in a garden and seeing that it worked, you plant and things grow and you look after them and then you can harvest things. Do you think somewhere, I mean, because we had gardens when I was a child, and I just remember the feeling. I don't remember all the things we did, but I remember the feeling of being in a garden and seeing things grow and going into the garden, picking things right, peas off the vine or carrots out of the ground and just eating them there. There's something special about that, seems to me.
There's something really special. I remember, for me, I started going to our allotment, which was a quarter of an acre in London, believe it or not. And I remember going there and just playing.
Mm-hmm.
Just playing and helping Dad, take a bucket of weeds to the compost pile or whatever. And my first job that I remember was actually being allowed to use his big knife, which I still have, and cut the slugs.
Mass murder. It's a wonderful thing.
But well, it was a family thing. It
yeah,
was something
sure.
something special
yeah.
that I did with my dad. So gardening to me was very special.
Well, I think it is. I mean, intrinsically, I think it just is. Having living things of different, completely different temperament. The seeds don't move, they don't run around, but they do things that are quite miraculous, so that it kind of draws us into a whole other world outside the human experience, which I think is, we're starting to understand how important that is for us, that if we're surrounded by different life forms or different species, it enriches our lives and makes us feel better and actually probably extends our lives.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. There's been studies done that have shown that even if you're living on the 10th floor in an apartment, if your view has trees and nature in it, then you will live longer.
Yeah, and studies have been done in hospitals, which I'm very familiar with, that show exactly what you've said, that if you're looking out on a pleasant natural vista, you actually get better, faster, and escape hospital food more quickly. Speaking of seeds, seeds can be, if you haven't grown your own, you can get seeds from people who have done the process of seed growing. You mentioned a number of them before the show, and I'd just like to name them off, and you could just tell listeners what is their virtue as a seed supply source. One you mentioned you've used for many years is William Dan. It's a seed company or concern in Ontario.
That was really special for me back when I started farming, because it was the one seed company that sold untreated seeds only. And you didn't have to worry about getting a package in the mail and them being treated.
Yeah, you'd open up and you see that pink color or something.
Exactly.
Like that.
Yeah. They were a family company, and I believe they also distribute their unused seeds at the end of the year to various charitable organizations. So they're just they were
that's
just
a lovely
just
thing
a
to
really
do.
Good company.
Yeah. So that's William Dam, DAM for listeners. Mm-hmm. William Dam in Ontario. Sunshine Farms in Kelowna.
Sunshine Farms, that's John Alcock. He is part of the local seed growing movement, and he has been growing seeds for many, many years. His son has now taken over the business. Mm. And you can find his seeds at seed swaps, and I saw a rack in Buckerfields. Mm. So it's also available in various retail stores.
And that's often an issue. Sometimes people, of course, seed packages are small. You can order them, you know, online and through.
Oh, absolutely.
But it's really nice if you can go and actually pick them off the shelf in mm-hmm. somebody's store. Mm-hmm. Another one is in Vernon, is Pacific Northwest.
Pacific Northwest used to be a large supplier for farms, and I don't know when it happened, but they stopped having large volumes available, but went into packaged seeds and selling them at local retails. They have good quality seeds. They're one of the lower cost seeds available, being a local company, you can be assured that their product will grow in our area.
Yeah, that's another thing you had mentioned, which is that you need to think of where you're going to plant the seeds and adapt the seeds to the or choose seeds that will flourish in the ecosystem in which you are planting.
Yeah. Yes. You know, a seed that you get from any seed company is going to grow for you.
And they usually say, do they not, what kind of circumstance it likes best.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. There's a lot of the websites in particular have huge amounts of information available on when to plant, where to plant, how much nutrition, whether they need a lot of water or not, right. etc.
They assume that the reader is not necessarily fully informed on the subject. Another company you mentioned from the States is called Fedco Seeds. Why don't you talk about them?
Fedco Seeds started selling into Canada about maybe 10 years ago. They're a cooperative, and they have a huge catalog. And they select seeds from a lot of different sources. So, for instance, you may get a broccoli grown in Hungary or something like this, but you will also get a tomato seed that's grown by Farmer Smith, who has developed it from something or other and is very proud of it, or somebody who has, kind of brought this seed from the old country, and this is the seventh generation they've been growing it, et cetera.
Slightly commercialized version of seed swapping.
It is. Yeah. It is. Yeah. It is. They're a lovely seed company. I like dealing with them.
And when they have a large range of seeds, they would have untreated seeds, and for the grower who wishes it, treated seeds, I suppose.
The majority of their seeds, I believe, are untreated.
And they're much easier to get now, untreated seeds.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Would you say they're dominant or got to the point where they're dominating the seed market for homeowners and small growers?
I would. The only seed that seems to be treated for the home gardener now is corn.
Hmm. And it doesn't have to be. No. No. Well, there's one more company, and that's Westcote Seed. But I thought when we were talking about it, we had the impression that they would probably be more suitable for people down at the coast because they do presentations and lectures and things like that. And that's the climate in which their seeds are mostly distributed.
Yeah, that's probably one of the larger BC seed companies. And they have a nice quality seed. They have a wonderful pack. They have an incredible planting schedule in their catalog.
Oh, really?
Yes, yes. It's
when
it's
and where?
When and where and whether you should use a transplant, et cetera, et cetera. It's a really nice product.
Now, one of the things that is worth spending a little time on is managing pests, because we call pests insects we don't like, and we call beneficials insects we do like. But they're all insects, and the biggest problem that I think sort of modern chemical agriculture has developed is that it uses substances that are non-specific. They don't distinguish between the good guys and the bad guys. And I know that through long experience you have learned clever ways to address the attentions of insects that want to eat the food that you'd like to eat. Why don't you just give us a little bit of an outline of what you have done in that respect?
Well, I think the one thing that I absolutely fell in love with was the Protect Net that I was talking about. Mm. Because that would protect carrots from the carrot rust fly. And the carrot rust fly has about 5 generations in a year. And if you
prolific.
Can, absolutely. But if you can manage to break the cycle by using Protect Net on, for instance, on your early crops, your later crops don't need it because you've broken the cycle.
I remind listeners that I'm speaking with Sue Moore, who is a quasi-retired, I'll call her that, organic farmer, former owner of Sudoa Farms, and very active and central to the teaching garden operated by the Shuswap Food Action Society. Well, I suspect we'll have a few listeners going to their local supply store and saying, do you have Protect Net? I think that would be really nice to have a little Protect Net. It seems to be working well for some
that,
very...
That, by the way, the only place that I found it in small quantities is through William Dam Seeds.
Oh, really?
Yes, it's in their catalog system.
And is it heavy item when you ship like a whole roll of it?
Oh, it would be if you shipped a whole roll of it for a length for one or two rows in a garden. It's quite reasonable.
Now let's shift our attention to the place where you are really actively involved. And that is the teaching garden. The teaching garden has been running for a number of years now at the far end of 30th Street, Northeast. I think I got that right. And it's quite a lovely place. It's a place where people come to grow things together and to learn more about how to do it properly. Why don't you talk a little bit about the general layout, the general disposition of the teaching garden, and sort of the main things that go on there?
Okay, well, first of all, I want to say that it's run by the Food Action Society, yeah. Shuswap Food Action.
Indeed.
If you go on the Shuswap Food Action website, you can sign up, which is absolutely free. You will then get the information. If you follow the prompts, you'll get the information about the garden. And we staff it with volunteers for as many mornings a week as we can. My mornings this year are Wednesdays and Sundays, I believe. and Sunday is always my day down there. And there are other people who staff it at other times. We also run workshops there.
Yes, and you have a couple of workshops coming up. Maybe you could just tell listeners what they are and when they are.
Oh, I hope I can remember. So it's on a Sunday, and I believe the first one is April the 14th, or the Sunday of that weekend. And it will be on working in the seed garden,
okay.
Learning about the perennial seeds. Sorry, not perennials, but biennials,
right.
and moving some of the plants into the garden and getting it ready.
So it's a mixture of hands-on and intellectual material.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely.
Isn't that the best way to do things?
It's kind of learn while you do.
Yes.
Yes. And then 2 weeks later, we have on the 28th, we have a big cleanup and compost moving. We need people with healthy, strong backs who want to do
but
some
but large
work.
Brains to go along with it.
And other people who maybe would like to even do some transplanting if we get round to it. There's lots of plants coming in. And we're hoping to get some plants and seeds in the ground as well.
Over the years that you've been involved with garden, have you noticed any sort of changes in how things happen there and how and who participates and the kind of state of mind of people as they come in?
Well, I've only been there for about 3 years.
Well, that's a good start.
Yes, and Elmarie and I started round about the same time. Mm. And Elmarie has an interest and expertise in permaculture. And she is running a small permaculture garden there.
Right.
Last year, we had a young woman who has expertise in honeybees. Oh, sorry, not honeybees, bumblebees.
One of my favorite life forms on planet Earth, bumblebees. Yes.
And she was responsible for setting up some bumblebee areas and houses and introducing a small garden, which is a bee attractant garden. So we have some small projects going on there. Actually, I wouldn't call them small. We have some projects going on there. We have the one I'm excited about this year, the seed saving project. And then about three quarters of the garden is used for production. And people can learn how to transplant, how to seed, how to a little bit about crop rotation. We're on a drip system, so a little bit about a drip system if they're interested. Some people just like to come in and do a little bit of weeding and go away again.
What would you say the first thing is when the snow melts and the land is the ground is exposed? What's the first thing that ends up having to be done or being done?
Well, basically clean up from the previous mm-hmm. year, and
that's leaves and branches and stems of plants that have, you know.
Absolutely, trimming those raspberries down so that they're going to be harvestable and not, you know, 3 feet above your head. And if you have a strawberry bed, maybe digging out the old dead plants and moving them around, this type of thing. Mm. And then planning. What am I going to plant? What am I going to plant where? How did the plants grow there last year? Do they need feeding this year?
And you have a map. And the map, this is the map of Treasure Island in the plant world. A map of the garden, and you've shared it with me, which is wonderful. I'm afraid, as it's radio, we can't have our listeners seeing it. But it is organized. It is organized. There is a sort of a plan. For example, Elmarie's permaculture garden is the far end because presumably it doesn't need as much ongoing attention. Once it's established, it's got perennials and they kind of take care of themselves to some degree. It does need some attention. But the garden overall, what kind of principles would you say you built into the layout of the garden? Because there are obviously some thought goes into it.
Well, for a garden, for a garden that is producing food that is going to be for the volunteers and the excess goes to the food bank. it's fairly small. So you can't, you can't really take a whole section out of production and get a really true crop rotation going.
Like a green compost sort of thing.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. But we do that bed by bed.
Okay.
Another difficulty is that we're all volunteers. Mm. And along with the weather, somebody would come in and see that there's a bare bed and think to themselves, oh, we've still got time to grow some cutting lettuce. I'll just put cutting lettuce in there. And so without thought to any rotation plan, right, that's what happens.
So is this map that's drawn up, is it something that will be posted so that people can see where things are supposed to go? Is it at that point, or is it?
Yes, we will post this. We will post this. And the major thing is that that there are pests within the garden. Specifically, we've had a lot of potato beetle and a small amount of carrot rust fly. And so there's certain things within the garden that we take a lot of care to move to different areas or not to grow one year or something like that.
And that it seems to me, is a basic principle of growing things without using chemicals, is you don't grow the same, almost without exception, you don't grow the same crop in the same place over and over and over.
That's correct, yes. And there's certain things, like certain things have hearty appetites, like your squash and your tomatoes, your broccoli. You know, they all really like that food. Mm. Whereas beans and peas will basically take their food from the air and produce a lot of their own food, and then leave it in the ground for your crop for next year.
Nitrogen fixation.
So nitrogen fixation. Mm. So understanding those kind of principles would allow you to do at least some crop rotation if you have to use 100% of your garden all the time.
Now, people talk about soil amendments. It's a nice term for putting some food into the soil. You use compost, but it's not compost from the garden itself. Talk about that a little bit.
Yes, I mean, on the farm, we only ever use farm compost with rare exception. But we cannot produce enough compost to provide nutrition at the teaching garden. And we bring, this year we're bringing in some chicken compost from Bland's. Mm. And we are aware of what crop needs to be fed well, mm-hmm, so that we would spread the compost on specific areas and leave others with no compost whatsoever.
Let's talk a little bit about animal compost, because there's sort of nutritional density, if you like, in animal-sourced compost versus plant-sourced. Could you just talk about that a little bit? Because it's a big subject for a lot of people.
The animal compost has different nutritional components. I'm not a total expert in this area, but basically your chicken compost and your horse compost are both high nitrogen, hot composts.
So they have to be composted
so
for a long time.
So they really have to be composted.
Cooled down.
Yes. If you're uncertain about your compost, the best thing to do is to put it on your garden, dig it in, and put a few seeds in. They will always come up, but if your compost is too hot, they will burn off. So then you have to, that garden can only be used for transplants, and we have to be really careful as we plant them, et cetera, et cetera. It's no good for putting.
But the compost, you're getting this load of chicken manure, you're aware of the fact that it's already been composted long enough to be usable directly.
Absolutely, absolutely. Mm. And with compost, the cooler composts would be your sheep, your goat, your rabbit. They would be your Yeah, and sometimes your mushroom manures, which I'm a little leery of, because anything from a mushroom farm obviously has had chemicals used on it. But it is a good source of nutrition.
Now you lay out the garden. You sort of group plants in certain ways. Why don't you describe how you would group plants? They don't just go higgledy piggledy.
The three main ones are heavy feeders, light feeders, and nitrogen fixers.
Who put back into the soil?
Yeah. So if you were going to grow equal amounts of those three crops, that would be almost ideal. And you could put your garden one third into heavy feeders, so you would put lots of compost on it, one third into nitrogen fixers, so you would, they would fix the nitrogen, and one third into low feeders, such as your carrots and your potatoes, and then they would not need to compost that year.
Probably most people have heard of the Three Sisters, and we maybe talk about them in a second, but I want to remind listeners that I'm talking with Sue Moore, quasi-retired organic farmer who is former owner of Sudoa Farms near Sorrento, and very actively involved in directing traffic and supporting the teaching garden that's run by the Shuswap Food Action Society. Now, compost is sort of dug into the soil most of the time. It's sort of mingled in with soil. That suggests that you would do it at the beginning of your growing process.
Absolutely, but you can apply it later in the season. You can band it around your plants, and then hopefully the rain will wash it into the plants. Or if you really need a fix for your plants, you can use a compost tea.
Yes, compost teas and liquid fertilizers. I'm thinking of things like fish fertilizer and seaweed fertilizer and compost tea. Obviously, you can use them all year round. I mean, all season long, if you wish to, if you think it's necessary, say, for the heavy feeders you were talking about. Is that something that plays a role in the teaching garden, or is it, do you get enough nutritional heft from the initial compost installation?
We haven't done any amending during the season. Mm-hmm. We have amended with the compost, of course, and then with certain plants, we might put a little blood meal. You could use a fish fertilizer to give them that first boost of nitrogen when you're planting to just give you a slightly stronger plant. Hopefully the compost would be sufficient, but I do add certain nutrients. And you know, like a heavy nitrogen for your leafy plants, and then the lower nitrogen, like the bone meal or the kelp for your fruiting plants. Mm.
Speaking of nitrogen, let's just for listeners do a brief run through the basics of what all plants need. They need light, more or less. They need water, more or less. And they need food, actual food. Can you just briefly run down the sort of basic parameters of each of those three key ingredients, if you like, to the plant world?
Well, different plants need different light. You can grow most plants in sunlight. However,
direct sunlight.
However, there are some which will also grow more than adequately in lower light. Things like lettuce, broccoli, cabbage, your kale, your chard. there are some which will not grow well if they don't have really good sunlight. Your tomatoes, your peppers, right. Your corn.
Plants that developed in more tropical parts of the world where there was more sun, more heat, just generally could stand being baked a little bit.
Probably. And within those families, that there's also tomatoes that will produce in cooler temperatures and tomatoes that will produce in hotter temperatures. Like you get a tomato from Russia will produce in cooler temperatures. You get a tomato from Syria or Italy will produce in higher temperatures. But they still both need the light, the sunlight.
And that brings out this fact that we have so many varietals, so many options available within a particular species like tomatoes. You can, as you say, get some that like certain conditions and others that like other conditions. And you really pick the ones that suit the place you're going to be growing them.
The place that you're going to be growing them, but also what you need. For instance, if you're going to go on vacation and the last 2 weeks of August and the first week in September, you want your tomatoes to be ready before you go or after you come back. So that's another consideration when you're planting your garden is, am I going on vacation this year? And who's going to look after the garden for me?
You told me about a situation this year, this spring, that you were out of town for a while. And that brings up an important point about gardening that you emphasized with me before. And that was that gardening is always a learning experience. And I think what you said was something will always go wrong, which sounds like a negative, but it's actually something to prepare people for the fact that you're not dealing with absolute certainty when you're growing things.
Correct. It's not mathematics. Mm. You know, there's no absolutely no certainty to growing things. If you have a wet, damp year and you happen to lose all of your lettuce to some kind of fungal rot, it doesn't mean that you're a bad gardener. Mm. It means that there was too much water that year, and it was probably absolutely nothing you could do about it. You just have to make sure that you don't grow lettuce in that spot again next year, because the spores from that rot will be in that area.
Waiting.
That's where your crop rotation becomes really important.
One of the ways that you mentioned the garden was organized was plants that need a lot of watering versus plants that didn't need so much watering. So there's a bit of an effect on the layout in that regard, is there not?
There's a lot you can think about in that regard, yes. For instance, one year at the farm, we planted leeks and onions together, and that was just a total disaster.
Really?
Because
they look like they're kissing cousins.
I know, and they grew so well until it became time to dry the onions, because then you couldn't water the leeks.
We're all sorry for you, poor leeks. That's such a terrible experience. Clearly, even somebody so experienced as you can, you know, it looks like it, or somebody anyway thought it looked like a good idea at the time. Talk a little bit about pest management beyond the obvious thing of, you know, shifting plants around the garden and using barriers like Remay and Protect Net. I've heard of people handpicking some pests.
We handpick at the garden. Mm-hmm. We handpick potato beetles, and we handpick them at a specific time of the year. You'll find that they start to emerge. Probably end of May, early June, and you'll see one or two mature beetles on your plants.
That's when the signal goes out?
And that's when the signal goes out. So you not only pick those two beetles off of your plant and crush them or squash them or otherwise dispose of them.
Turn them into compost.
Yes. What you do is you push over your potato plants and look at the underside of the leaves and those little orangey yellow nests of eggs. Mm. And you'll often find 5 or 6 leaves on one potato plant with these little orangey things under them. And that's the best time to get rid of them is before they emerge.
Do you ever get kids to do that? I just have this notion that, you know, they pick the orange stuff off and squish it. Would be appealing to kids. Maybe I'm just projecting.
I think it might be appealing to kids, but it would be appealing to kids who are a little bit older. And you'd probably have to go by behind them. And, you know, like if you were really wanting to
all
do
of
it.
The little orange
yeah,
lumpy it's, things.
If you have a few weeds in your potatoes, it's also a good time you go through, you weed the plants, you turn the plant over. You weed the plant, you turn the plant over. Just to check the undersides. Yeah.
You mentioned that in a kind of general rule with commercial gardening is that if you have up to 15% of loss because of pests of one sort or another, that's still considered a viable growing operation.
That's what we used to use as a rule of thumb at the farm. Mm. And it's not just pests. Mm. I mean, it would be water damage or
all of the different things. That could
all
happen.
Of the, all of the different things, some kind of, infertility of your seed that you used for some reason, anything, or, you know, the crows coming in and eating all your corn. One year we had pheasants that were very fat and healthy, but we had no corn to sell.
Well, one plays one's price role in the ecosystem, and that's always valuable. There's another garden opening up. I think Melanie Bennett from the Shuswap Food Action Society is starting something up at the Fall Fair grounds.
Yes.
It's going to be a much smaller scale operation.
Yes, I'm not fully aware of everything that's happening. It's mm. I know it's in progress as we speak. That's where Melanie's energy is going right now to get all the permits and donations and other things together. And from my recollection, it's going to be a demonstration type garden. But there should be beds available for individuals to grow their own product.
As you sort of look at the world of growing things, for example, the fact that now many, many seed sellers make available untreated seeds, whereas when you first started out, you had to order them from Ontario because that was one of the few places where you could get them. Have you noticed trends that are leading toward what most thoughtful people would think we need to do, expanding the local food production systems as well as locations, expanding the use of more regenerative practices in growing things and avoiding the sort of chemical dependency issue that's been, you know, the heart and soul of the so-called green revolution, but now is no longer considered such a desirable goal. Do you see patterns that tell you we're heading in the right direction?
Oh, definitely. When we first moved up into this area, we drove our product down to farmers markets in East Vancouver and Coquitlam. And we also, after a few years, had to drive our product to Kelowna to a distribution service. Now, the distribution service is still going and is very viable. But the farmers markets, we now have one in Salmon Arm. We have one in Sorrento. We have one in
Actually, two in Salmon Arm. We have the organic and they are the downtown.
Absolutely. Yes. We have one in Scotch Creek.
Yeah. You go to the Sorrento
one. There's one at Mabel Lake.
Yes, yes.
Enderby, Armstrong.
And they are really good places for farmers.
Because they're really good.
You put the money straight into their hand. There's no middle person taking a share.
Yeah, when I first started, the Kamloops Farmers Market was going. But because we already had a face at the East Vancouver, we chose to go there. But eventually we went to Kamloops as well, which I think is the oldest farmers market in BC.
It is. I've talked to people from there. Yeah. We're coming to the end of this show, but I want to make it clear that the Teaching Garden is a very active place, and Sue Moore is going to be present there twice a week,
at least.
And dispensing the kind of wisdom she shared with us today. So I want to thank you, Sue Moore, former owner of Sudoa Farms, and a very active teaching element and person in the Teaching Garden. And I want to thank you once again for being on the show and joining us and sharing your extensive knowledge of growing things.
Well, thank you, Warren.
Always a pleasure.